From the Gettysburgian and 91.1 WZBT Gettysburg, I'm Jamie Welch, and this is On Target.
I'm Ben Pons. Is a new name on the horizon for the bullet hole? Today on Target, we'll share all the details of the Gettysburgian's exclusive interview with bullet hole manager Mike Bishop about what's in store for the new Cub Eatery.
Then, we'll talk to Gettysburg College junior Spencer King about his background, his studies, and his involvement on campus. Stay with us.
Welcome to On Target for another exciting edition. We missed you all very much last week. Things happen, so we're glad to be back this week. We have a really exciting and fascinating interview with Spencer King coming up later in the program. You're not going to want to miss that. But first, let's talk about some of the news that's been happening on campus. Before we get into it, I do want to offer a clarification slash correction from a prior edition of this podcast. A few weeks ago, while discussing Senate budget-related matters, we noted that the International Affairs Association, more commonly known as Model UN, had recently been appropriated $4,700 approximately by the Senate, and we said that it was for an international conference. In fact, it is for two domestic conferences, one to Ithaca, New York, and one to Washington, D.C. Model UN does go on an international jaunt, I believe, to London, but that funding comes from the provost's office, separate from Senate. So the $4,700 funds its two domestic trips, and then the provost's office provides funding for those other trips. Thus endeth the correction clarification. Why don't we start with Senate this week? So Senate met on Monday, and as I understand it, based on our reporting, as well as conversations I've had with some senators, they made some pretty quick work of three budget requests, adjourned, and got out of there in a half an hour, which is not something that they've been apt to do recently. I know that a couple weeks ago, Dean Julie Ramsey came to give what I think was supposed to be a 20 or 30-minute presentation and only had like 7 minutes to go.
Yeah, she got the old shutout from being able to speak. Very interesting.
Well, I think she seemed to be okay with it. From what I heard, she was glad that there was some spirited debate. But in any case, they approved a budget request for YAF, Young Americans for Freedom, to bring Bay Buchanan, the sister of the noted Pat Buchanan. Bay Buchanan, a former treasurer of the United States under Ronald Reagan, a conservative commentator, will speak on abortion. The YAF has framed this as a continuation of dialogue begun on campus by college Democrats earlier this year when former NARAL president Kate Michaelman came to speak. So about $3,000, I do believe, was appropriated towards Bay Buchanan. Democrats on their own got another speaker approved, someone from an organization called Run for Something, which encourages young people to run for something, run for office. And finally, Outer Space was reimbursed a few hundred dollars or less, if I'm not mistaken, towards an event it held last weekend. So a pretty quick Senate meeting. Jamie, what do you make of all of the Senate budgetary matters we've been discussing, as well as, in just a second, we'll get into a new amendment that was passed?
Yeah, I think, trying to make Senate go faster, definitely a step in the right direction. But going back to our little correction, we previously thought that the $4,500 was for an international trip for 17 students. And, the fact that we were mistaken, and it's actually just for a trip around the good old United States of America, $4,500 for 17 total students between two trips. Interesting. Very interesting. This conference's discussion, I know that certain senators are thinking about introducing some possible amendments to the Constitution to address the conference's issue, but I continue to say that it's something they need to take a look at. It's not going away anytime soon. But in regards to The other budget requests, I think they were all fairly routine. Nothing, you know, of note really this week.
Yeah, and now on to the amendment that was passed. This was passed at its meeting last week, which I guess would have been October the 20-something. It was their last meeting in October. Our reporting reads, my very own reporting reads, after weeks of spirited discussion in meetings of the Senate as to whether the body should offset overhead costs of club fundraisers, since clubs get to keep all the proceeds, Senate voted to amend its constitution by introducing a section that would require clubs to reimburse Senate the amount allotted for fundraisers. So in other words, if the Gettysburgian were a Senate-funded organization, which we're not, we're funded through the College Life Office here at Gettysburg, but if we were a Senate-funded organization and we wanted $50 to go buy flour and sugar and nonsense to do a bake sale, after we did that bake sale, we would be required to reimburse Senate that $50. Whether or not our bake sale raised $50, I think this is an effort to encourage people to be more prudent in and judicious in the amount they're requiring for fundraisers. I mean, in years in the past, and I should note, there is an exception to this amendment for fundraisers that benefit external causes. So if, for example, our bake sale were to benefit disaster relief in Puerto Rico or Florida or Texas, that would be a different case. Fundraisers which fund organizations on campus in the past, we could have gotten $50 to go buy ingredients for this bake sale and then kept every dime that was made by the bake sale. So there was really, as long as you sold one item for $1, you know, it was a profitable fundraiser to your club, even if, you know, you took $50 from Senate. Certainly, this amendment makes logical sense to me. Your thoughts, Jamie?
I think that it's a great step because there has been a big loophole in the past where I know a lot of organizations would get the Senate money, buy a lot of materials and t-shirts and things that they would never hope to recover all of the money from, but they didn't care because they got all of the upswing and none of the downside, and Senate was left holding the bag.
I will just one other item back to the amendment. It was drafted in the Senate policy, drafted and then sent to the Senate Policy Committee, at which point it was presented to the Senate. It passed with an overwhelming majority in the full Senate. One senator who voted against it, however, was sophomore Callie Fucarino. She opposed the amendment because she believed it discouraged club fundraising. And she said that, quote, "As I know, we must begin saying no to budgets and pinching pennies. I'm hoping there is a way to do this, and while still encouraging groups to hold their fundraisers, then use their raised money in their own way." So I think largely it seemed to be fairly uncontroversial, although I will note that they spent considerable time discussing the amendment. So certainly perhaps some more deliberation than Senate has often seen. But I know Nick Arbaugh wrote a column in the Gettysburgian a few weeks ago indicating his desire for Senate to become a more activist body. He actually floated this amendment in that editorial, encouraged senators to rise to the level of debate that befits an organization such as Senate, in his view. And I know after this amendment, he told me that this is a triumph of Senate's willingness to take on the mantle of an organization that takes itself seriously. And I think that he said it was important in his editorial. He said it was important for Senate to spurn its status as the, quote, financial yes men of the entire school. And this was a budgetary reform that he was very pleased to see implemented. He noted that it was a big step for Senate. And Pat McKenna, who's the chair of the policy committee, also said that it was important for Senate to start delineating clearly what it will and will not fund. Nick Arbaugh's quote was, "The passage of my amendment shows that the Senate is willing and ready to reform itself to become the activist body it aspires to be." That's all I've got on Senate. Anything else on that topic, Jamie?
I think that's all we have to say about Senate. Why don't we move on to the bullet hole?
Yeah, so the bullet hole, a couple weeks ago slash last week, I sat down, I guess it was last Wednesday, I sat down with Mike Bishop, who is the manager of the bullet hole. Students would probably know him if they saw him, although he's not necessarily out a lot in the serving line area, but you'd probably know him if you saw him. Anyway, Mike Bishop and I sat down to talk about a potential new name for the bullet hole. There are four options, and just earlier today, we're recording this on Thursday, November the 9th, and they just sent out an email earlier today encouraging students to vote on a potential new name, and the four suggestions they offered were The Terrace, Food for Thought, 1832, and The Bullet Hole. Jamie, you're smirking and perhaps snickering over there. Is there one of those names you don't like?
I just think a lot of these names just don't sound very good. Like Food for Thought, that is pretty unoriginal. And The Terrace, I don't even know what that is.
The Terrace refers to the patio area.
Right.
Outside. I tried, while I was considering some of these name suggestions, I tried to envision myself saying to someone else on campus, "Hey, do you want to go to Food for Thought?" Don't know about that.
Yeah. Also, who was going to say, "Let's head over to the 1832 and grab a burger"? Like, who is going to say that?
Well, I don't think that one would have a "the" in front of it. I think it would be, "Let's go to 1832.
Well, that's even dumber. That's even dumber. Like, "Let's go to 1832. We can hop in our DeLorean and go back in time. What is this? You know, we got Doc coming out of, you know, it's unbelievable."
I don't know. The suggested names, I thought 1832 was one of the better ones. The Terrace was the other suggestion. And, of course, Bullet Hole remains a suggestion. I know at the faculty meeting there was conversation about this particular issue. Were you at that faculty meeting, Jamie?
I was. I believe it was Jocelyn Swigger, who is, I believe, a professor in the music,
She's
the Sunderman Conservatory of Music.
She's a professor of piano in the conservatory, yes.
Well, she got up, and I'm not exactly sure how she's connected to the bullet hole. Maybe she's on some committee that deals with dining, but I don't know. She got up and waxed poetic about how the bullet hole is a violent name and how it triggers our students, and we need to rename the bullet hole, and what a great opportunity it is to rename the bullet hole to something less violent like the 1832. They tried to do this notably once before. I believe it was in the late 90s. They renamed the bullet hole to Cafe 101. And the students kept calling it the bullet hole, so that only lasted a couple months, and it was back to the bullet hole. So I don't really know how this name change is going to work out for them.
I've spoken to several dozen students since I published this article just to get their perspective on the new name. Not a single student suggested that they could ever envision themselves calling it anything other than the bullet hole.
It'll always be the bullet hole to me, I tell you that.
Well, of course, you're a geezer who's about to graduate.
So I know, I am so old.
Us youngins who have more years of dining at the college.
It's time to put me in the home, Ben.
Yeah, really, you're going off the deep end over here. Anyway, on some news that I think was received more positively about the bullet hole is that some new food menu options will be available. Notably, they will be expanding. There's more space, is the bottom line. There is triple the floor space between the kitchen, the serving area, and the seating area in this new bullet hole as there is compared to the old bullet hole. And so they have a lot more options of what they can do. There's going to be an expanded salad bar. There's going to be a pizza, pasta sort of station that will be available every day. There will be more specials throughout the week. There are more options of what they can serve at breakfast. Mike Bishop mentioned the possibility of more hot breakfast sorts of options. They're still evaluating what makes the most sense, but they're equipped to do pancakes, French toast, things of that nature if they see a student demand for it. Sushi will be there and potentially available as part of a meal in certain capacities. And so it just sounds like there will be more stuff available. Of course, everything that's currently available at the temporary bullet hole and was available at the old bullet hole should be available at the new, in the new space. There will also be more beverage options, including potentially some of the more merchandising, convenience store style refrigerators. So overall, it sounds like it will be a nice space. We've seen renderings. They're published on our website at gettysburgeon.com. You could actually go to gettysburgeon.com/cub. That's a different article, but you'll see all of the renderings in a slideshow there. But it looks like a really nice space, Jamie.
It really does. And interestingly, they're talking about mobile ordering and being able to come pick it up, which is exciting. I think they have a lot of ambition going in, and I just hope they're not biting off more than they can chew. But if they can have mobile ordering and it works well, that'll be a real game changer, because I know a lot of people who even say they're too busy to go to the bullet hole now, and that they would actually like to be able to have something ready to just pick up and grab and go in between classes.
Yeah, and actually I should have mentioned that. Mike Bishop mentioned that they realize that at lunchtime lines are voluminous. Okay, that was a bad joke. Just pretend that. Edit that one out. No, actually leave it in. There are a lot of lines around lunchtime, particularly, as well as some of the dinner time, but particularly around lunchtime, and they're in an effort to address that. I think they're certainly coming at this from a how can we serve the campus community more efficiently. And the idea is that he hesitated to call it an app, although I think that's basically what he described. You can order on your mobile device. It will be connected to your meal plan so that you'll pay for it in the application or whatever it is, and that you'll be able to go pick it up. And Mike Bishop said that, if he can take 100 people out of the line at lunchtime a day, and it helps people who may be visiting campus, get food more quickly. It sounds like an interesting idea. Again, I've heard some skepticism from the campus community on that issue in talking to people since, but it'll be interesting to see what happens. The other thing worth noting is that Commons will be getting a facelift as part of this transition as well. It will have more merchandising sorts of space, some more grocery type items, which I know many students are excited about. There will be an opportunity, for example, to get a mac and cheese or a soup or something to heat up in a micro fridge,
as it were, the micro fridges.
Recently, this is a quick side tangent. Jamie's giving me the finger that it's time to wrap this up. Just that finger, no other fingers. Anyway. I was sitting in a group, and I can't remember what group it was, but we were going around the room. It was like an introduction sort of thing. And we were saying our name, our class year, our major, and favorite appliance, kitchen appliance, which is just kind of weird. But anyway, the amount of times microfridge came up as someone's favorite kitchen appliance was
disturbing.
Indicative of the fact that there are not a whole lot of kitchen appliances that many students have access to in their current residential situations.
Well, there you go.
And with that, we'll go to the Sounds of Sunderman segment. Today, we will be hearing the Gettysburg College Camerata, accompanied by the Gettysburg College Jazz Ensemble. This is a recent performance from just last week at their combined concert. We hope you enjoy the Gettysburg College Jazz Ensemble and Gettysburg College's Camerata Chamber Singers.
I took a trip on a train. And I thought about you, I thought about you. I passed a shadowy lane, and I thought about you. Two ugly cars parked under the stars, a winding street. Moon shining down on some little town, and with each beat, same old dream. At every stop that we made, oh, I thought about you, the things that you do. But when I pulled down the shade, then I really
What a fantastic joint performance there. Now I believe we have Ben Ponce with our bullet report.
It's been 2 weeks since we did this, but since college sports have been wrapping up this fall, there's not a lot to tell you. But there's enough that it's worth doing this anyway. On October the 27th, the field hockey team lost to Dickinson 3-2, but the next day the football team avenged its prior drubbings and won 29-21 over Susquehanna. The women's soccer team won later that day 1-0 over Dickinson, and the volleyball team beat Dickinson 3-0. The women's swimming team picked up a 131-69 win on that Saturday as well, and the men's soccer team beat Ursinus 2-1. The next day, the men's cross-country centennial conference championships, the men's cross-country team finished 6th out of 9 teams, while the women's cross-country team finished 5th out of 10. Elizabeth Hillfrank, our very own co-sports editor, is heading on, so good luck to her. There will be more coverage on the Gettysburgians website later this week. The women's soccer team on November the 1st lost 1-0 to McDaniel. The men's soccer team also lost 1-0 to Franklin and Marshall that same, 2 days later on November the 3rd. On November the 4th, the wrestling team went to Messiah for the Messiah preseason invitational. They finished 3rd out of 10. The men's swimming team beat Washington College 164-98 on the 4th. The women's swimming team beat Washington College 164.5-96.5 on that same day. And the football team was roundly defeated by Muhlenberg 39-14. Thus endeth the bullet report.
It's probably the last of those that we're going to be having for a while. I mean, well, I guess we have some winter sports kicking up.
Yeah, but winter sports will be kicking in pretty soon. But
it'll be fairly abbreviated for a little while here, the bullet report.
Well, don't worry. I'll get through it even faster in those times.
Absolutely. You get it down to the 15-second bullet report instead of just a 30-second bullet report.
Yeah, I was asked the other day, do you say these at a normal speed and then they just speed you up? No, I just talk fast.
Absolutely. It is impressive. And I say it every week, but he gets faster and faster every time. We'll be right back with Spencer King.
Okay, and we're joined today by Spencer King, a junior economics and international affairs double major with a Middle East and Islamic studies minor. Did I get all that right?
Yeah, I'd say so.
All right, well, so far, so good. We're off to a great start. So, Spencer, thanks so much for joining us.
No, thank you.
So you were born and raised in Kenya?
Nah, I was actually born in the United States in Oregon. Uh-huh. In a small town called Springfield.
Uh-huh.
But then when I was one, I spent the rest of my life in Kenya. My family moved and haven't really left.
So you have no real memories of Oregon?
I would come back to visit like relatives and such. So like I do know Oregon. I go there about once or twice a year. But mostly of my memories are back at home in Kenya.
And talk about growing up in Kenya. What was that like?
I'm
sure for you, you have no real point of comparison to others' experiences, but
it was different. I can guarantee you that it's not like what you think. Kenya's actually quite a nice country. We've been improving every single year. It's quite amazing. Actually, getting to watch it myself. We do have internet. We do have electricity, but I lived on a boarding school. Actually, my mom and dad worked at an international boarding school. It's now, I think, 107 years old. I don't know. It's called Rift Valley Academy. But I've lived there my entire life. My mom and dad are teachers and dorm parents. So I got to live at school, for better or for worse. And the people in my community happen to be my teachers, for better or for worse, especially when you get in trouble. But yeah, it was interesting because there's a lot of cultures molding and melding where I was.
What kind of a boarding school was it? Were you going to school with people who had lived in Kenya their entire lives? Or
so Rift Valley Academy is a bit different than what you would think of as the United States boarding schools. So a lot of schools are put in Kenya because it's been stable for so long. There's a massive number of international schools. Rift Valley Academy is one of four American international schools and the only one of those that is a boarding school and the oldest of them. But basically, all that means that they offer an American education. So we have APs, but we also offer IGCSEs, A-levels, and the other things associated with British education. And so we have both of those combined. But for the most part, it's very focused on APs and American education. That being said, the people who are there, they range from multiple citizenships and living in different countries. For example, my roommate in junior year, his name was Hagos Na. And Hagos is originally a Korean citizen from South Korea. He was born in Eritrea, and then his family was kicked out due to some unrest in Eritrea. Shocking. And then he grew up in Kenya, moved to Uganda, moved to Rwanda, and came back to school in Kenya.
Wow.
So that's everyone's kind of from all over, people from Morocco to South Africa.
And how did people get to this particular school?
So a long time ago, they actually used to come by train. So our school is located on a rail line, but now we don't do that anymore because that's just, you know, a little bit time consuming. So most people come by car or they'll fly into Nairobi and be picked up by one of our buses and then drive 2 hours out into the countryside, into the hills where we are. Mm-hmm.
Was instruction in English or in Swahili or?
So, good call. So Kenya's national languages are English and Kiswahili. And our instruction was in English because we're an international school. So that's the main focus. However, it was in our foreign language department and everyone knows a bit of Kiswahili to get around. My Kiswahili is really quite poor right now, but I used to be semi-fluent, if not fluent.
Mm-hmm.
In Kenyan Kiswahili, which if you talk to a Tanzanian, they'll make fun of us. So have to put
some
that caveat.
International rivalry.
We have a better economy.
So when did you first decide or when did you move back to the U.S. From Kenya? Was it when you applied here to school or was it earlier than that? Can you talk a little bit about that experience coming back?
Yeah. So the decision to come to the U.S. wasn't actually my decision. I started looking at universities in Scotland and in England, in Austria, in Qatar. I looked there as well in the Middle East. And my mom saw where I was planning on applying and said, no, you need to go back to America. the two holidays in our household that are a little bit contentious is the 4th of July and Thanksgiving, because we don't really get what's going on and we don't have the fireworks because they're banned at certain times of the year. That's also when the dry season is. So you could light things on fire. So really you just get sparklers. But that's when my parents decided to act more American than normal. But my mom wanted us to go back to America for our university. So all four of us have to. So that's when I was told, you're going to go back to America. You're not staying here. So that was how it got decided for me. But really, it was just when I was told that, my dad and I came and looked at universities across the U.S. We visited 14 and 13 days from Boston to Tennessee. So that was
a lot.
It was brutal.
And so how did you settle, looking at those 14 schools, how did you settle on Gettysburg?
So actually, interestingly enough, our college advisor in Kenya, he was like, yeah, you should totally apply to this school. 14 kids from my school have applied and been accepted. I'm just happened to be the first one and still the only one to come. yeah, you gotta be special somehow. But I decided I'd check it out, and I liked the campus, and they had what I was looking for. They're close enough to D.C. and close enough to New York, because if you're doing international affairs, I want to one day work for the Foreign Service, so you kind of got to be close to those two hubs.
Yeah, Gettysburg really does have a very unique location, being so close to D.C. and then also to Philly and Baltimore and all these big hubs, and really not that far to New York either if you go by train. So that is a really interesting feature of Gettysburg. So once you came here to Gettysburg, what was the adjustment like to move? I mean, it was an international school, so I'm just wondering if it was similar to what you experienced in your education in Kenya, or if it was different.
It was quite different on a few levels. First off, I'm not used to being in the majority. In Kenya, I'm a minority. So that was a shocker, seeing so many white people. So that was one shocker, but also like just cultural differences. The words that you use, for example, I got in trouble for using the word rubber when I meant eraser, and that they have different connotations, as you know. But a lot of things with just not understanding the cultural humor or like what you guys thought was entertaining. I mean, I don't understand American football. And still do not to this day. So that's been an adjustment. I'm trying, though. The quarterback throws the ball forward. I think I've got it.
On a good path.
Pretty much it, yeah.
In a nutshell. So you decided, you got here, and you already spoke you said Kiswahili,
mm-hmm.
and English, obviously, and you decided to pick up another language,
yeah.
in Arabic. What made you choose Arabic?
Quite a few things. So first off, Kiswahili actually comes from the Arabic word Sahel, and Sahel means coast. Saheli means one of the coast. In Kiswahili, the word Ki means language. So Ki Saheli. And so Arabic and Kiswahili are both trade languages. Kiswahili just happens to be the Bantu one. So they've always been interacting. So we have a lot of words in common. And a lot of my friends lived on the coast in Kenya. Therefore, there's a lot more Arabic than Kiswahili, actually, or really nice Kiswahili. So I decided that would be a fun language to learn. I've always been interested in the Middle East, and it's a very valuable one for foreign policy. But to be honest, I've just fallen in love with it. So,
and after your first year, you did a critical language scholarship.
Yeah.
I did my research. I've been stalking you on the college website. So
you stalked me on Facebook, too?
I don't know about that.
How far back did you go?
Just to, last year. So
don't
worry. Nothing. The beans won't come out if there are any. But
no
anyway.
Embarrassing photos.
No. So you did a critical language scholarship in Oman, and in case people aren't aware, do you want to place Oman on a map for us? It's south of Saudi Arabia.
No, it's actually east. If you like of the bulk, technically parts of it are south.
Uh huh.
And then it's northeast of Yemen.
Mm-hmm.
And east of the UAE, except Oman is interesting because there's actually three different parts of it. There's the main part, and then if you look in the UAE near the eastern coast, zoom in a bit, and you'll see a circle, a little tiny circle surrounded by the UAE. That is part of Oman. And if you go to the north of the UAE, that is also part of Oman. So it's, I was in the main part though.
And so what was it like being in Oman for the summer? And you were doing a critical language scholarship through the U.S. Department of State.
Yeah.
And so talk a little bit about that.
So the critical language scholarship program is actually a fantastic program for anyone who's studying a language that is critical to U.S. Foreign policy or trade relations. I really encourage it. That's just, you know, the little side note I should give in.
A good plug.
So basically what it is it's a program that is pushing you to be able to speak and use the language. So much of language that's being taught is from a textbook, and that's not very living. You read it, you learn grammar, and that's about it. You learn some cool vocab words like Al-Umam Al-Mutahida or the United Nations that you can never really use. But then so the State Department gives a fully funded scholarship, flights, also your language education, your visas. Everything is paid for, and you go to a country and you're immersed in the culture and the language. So for 2 months, approximately 24/7, I was speaking Arabic, which is a bit daunting after only speaking for 1 year. You have to describe things as that is good, that is bad, I don't like. You sound like a little kid, and it's really hard to express yourself. But by the end, you begin to really form good sentences and really enjoy it. And it's just fun to get to see another culture and live within that culture as well. I had a language partner, his name was Naif Al-Ghafri. He was fantastic, absolutely amazing. He was actually he's a Bedouin, but we went on all these sorts of adventures and got to see Oman, but also got to enjoy cultural parts of Oman that everyone lives with every day. Such as, well, I guess not every day if it's Ramadan, but got to experience Ramadan and just what it's like to live in Oman in the Middle East.
And I read in that article that appeared on the college website that you attended a handful of weddings while you were there, just, you know, out
of the... You gotta get free food, man. It's good stuff.
So how did that come to be?
So the first wedding was actually Knife's cousin's nephew. It was like some really distant person. He said, oh yeah, there's a wedding in this town about 30 minutes away. We're gonna go over there for lunch. And we went there for lunch and just kind of waited out, and we ate some food, congratulated the groomsmen and the groom, and then walked off. It was a little bit interesting, but the best one was actually one of our professors got married while we were there, Yasser. And he was just a really nice guy, and we didn't know he was getting married. And all of a sudden he goes, oh, by the way, you're all invited to my wedding. And that was quite a surprise, because we just thought he was just, you know, a single guy, we're already married. And that one was a lot of fun. We got a, I'm sure the women did more. We just kind of sat around and chatted and congratulated the groom. It's not like a Western wedding, and we ate food, and oh, it was good. Rice and camel.
So what kinds of foods did you have, not just at the weddings, but throughout your time in Oman?
A lot of dates. I love dates, except I do not love fresh dates, only red fresh dates. Actually, Oman apparently is like the third best place in the world to get dates. Who knew? No one really knows where Oman is.
That's why we asked you to put it on a map.
Yeah, good point. I ate a thing called halwa. Halwa means sweet, but it's or like a dessert. And halwa al-Umaniya is this, think of it kind of like molasses. It's like molasses pudding that you eat with your fingers. There's really no way to describe it. Either you like it or you hate it. I drank a lot of coffee. In Oman, you have to drink coffee in odds, because I think Muhammad drank them in odds. I'm not really sure. Again, that was conveyed to me in Arabic. So I'm pretty sure Muhammad was drinking in odds, or he drank in evens, but a lot of coffee, tea, rice, hummus. Oh, the hummus at Servo, it doesn't do justice to real hummus. One day.
Did you have any other good stories from Oman that you could share?
Yeah. So I think, let's see which one. I got to meet a sheikh, and that was fun. Didn't know he was a sheikh. And basically, we're just chilling, and we went to this guy's camel stables. And I learned that there are three types of camels. There are racing camels, milk camels, and model camels. Uh-huh. As in, like, you know, walking down the runway, strutting.
So do they have, like, camel shows, like we have dog shows where they have, yes, like, show camels? That is so interesting.
It was. I couldn't figure out the difference. All I could tell is the model camels had a lot of nose rings. That was the only thing I could really tell. I mean, they did look genuinely better, but not like, ooh, look at that camel. So we're just sitting there, and he goes, oh, yeah, and the sheikh invited us for supper. And so what turns out is he decided to break the fast that day of Ramadan at his personal mosque. So everyone who lived in the area came to his personal mosque for his feast to break the fast. We got to eat a camel that he'd slaughtered that day. And we had no idea because my Arabic was so small. I was just like, oh, this is a great time. And then I was told, no, we have to go to the second meal. And then we went to this giant patio in the middle of the desert. Just right next to the mosque, but it was a little bit farther away. And it was his meeting hall for the entire tribe. So it could hold about 3,000 people. And he feeds 3,000 people in Eid, in the celebration of the end of Ramadan there, which is, it's crazy that he can feed that many people. And we just met this sheikh who wanted to speak English because he's planning on coming to the U.S. for a visit. But yeah, he was a fascinating guy. He wanted to practice his English for the TOEFL.
Interesting. I know a lot of people do want to practice English before that exam. That's an exciting or challenging time, I would imagine. So you came back to Gettysburg then, and you participated in the Eisenhower Institute's Inside the Middle East program. How did you become interested in that, and what did you learn, appreciate, enjoy, not enjoy, et cetera, about that program with Avi Melamed, our instructor for that program?
When I started taking Arabic, I realized I really like this language. I really like this place, like this culture. And, Inside the Middle East is another logical step if you want to go to the Middle East. And it's a fantastic program. I can't say enough about it. Like, it's just, it's amazing. The things I didn't like, though, I can get that out of the way, was probably just like, we had to sit in a room here in Gettysburg and hear about the Middle East. After about 6 hours, you're just kind of like, oh, okay. I'm hearing the same thing as 6 weeks ago in Gettysburg, PA. I'm a world away. But I loved it because you got to see the Middle East from a Middle Eastern perspective. And that's something that we're really missing. So often we love, I personally fall to this all the time. We love our own programs like the New York Times or Fox or CNN. And we get trapped just in that. And we only read those stories. But it's essential to see what the other side stories are as well. And not that they're worse or better or anything. I think that all stories have a bias in them. And you have to learn to see what the bias is, which Inside the Middle East pushes. But you also get to see what they're seeing is valuable. If in the U.S. we're focusing on there was a terror attack in Lebanon, I mean, that's what sells in the U.S. But maybe Al-Bawaba is talking about how a Saudi prince decided to donate $8 million to some charity in Saudi Arabia, or how the Syrian crisis is looking like it's getting better. It's not, but things like that. And so you get to see a different story. And that's something that Avi really pushes, is going to the source, going to the true information. I studied ISIS in Mosul, and like what would happen after ISIS was eliminated. Because it's pretty clear, and they are eliminated from there now, but it's pretty clear when I was researching that they were going to leave, but what were the problems that would come up? So Avi pushed us to keep looking, but also to make predictions, and I think that's really valuable.
So what predictions have you made about what will happen in Mosul?
None good. basically, my predictions were based off of what Iraqi spokesmen have said, and if you look at it, Mosul is actually a Sunni city, but it's Iraq is run by Shias, and they don't seem to like each other at all, to simplify the matter. And originally, when ISIS came, they were actually welcomed into Mosul. That's why Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi could even give his speech at the Great Mosque. However, now that there's been that tension, when it was happening, it looked like we'd begin to hear ethnic cleansing coming out, because if you looked at who was going in, it was Shias, Shia militias, and Kurds. And they've all watched their own people die from ISIS. They're going into a Sunni place, they're not sure. And some of them think that all Sunnis are bad, which is clearly not true, and nor are all Shias good. My other prediction was basically if you have a city that's been ravaged by a horrible terrorist organization, there's going to be problems with children growing up, psychological issues, policing issues, mistrust between neighbors, and that's going to lead to a lot of violence and unrest in the future as it continues to be there unless we deal with it head on.
Challenges certainly seem to lie ahead in that region. I just have one more question about that. You mentioned that you were reading a lot of Middle Eastern-based news sources. Were you able to read them in the original Arabic? Had your skills grown to that point? Or
So news Arabic is hard. Sometimes like I would challenge myself. But the thing is, I'm much better at speaking Arabic than reading. It's very hard, and I wish I was better. That's one thing that I really have appreciated about the CLS and actually getting to go to the Middle East with EI. After that, I went to Morocco and had an internship at an English language center, but using Arabic and speaking it. My Arabic for reading is horrible, but when I get to talking, I can hold my own for a bit.
So you said that you had an internship at a language center in Morocco?
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about that experience?
Yeah. So the language center I went to is in a town called Agadir. Do you know argan oil?
Yeah.
So argan oil is only produced in about a 20-kilometer stretch, like 20-kilometer wide stretch, maybe I'd say 200 kilometers long in Morocco. It's the only place in the world that you can get argan oil. And that's actually where Agadir is. So Agadir is in that strip. It's on the coast, down near the Western Sahara. But in Morocco, I guess we won't say Western Sahara because that's part of Morocco, according to them. But, excuse me. So I went there and was working at an English language center called Anglosphere. I was the only American working there, which is always interesting when you have to speak on behalf of all the Americans and you haven't really lived in America very long.
All 320 million people.
Yeah, I don't know if I really represented them well, but I did my best. I worked with two British couples, and basically my job was running the conversation club, which just like it's essential for us to learn other languages, how to speak them, it's also essential for them to learn how to speak English and not just read it. And so we did games and had topics. I gave talks on everything from Julius Caesar's assassination to why we need more solar panels in the world. It's primarily using TED Talks, which are a fantastic resource. But also playing games such as Settlers and trying to teach that to people with minimal English and trying to give them something that's actually useful, not just textbook knowledge. So that was primarily my job. Also administrative tasks, but no one wants to hear that.
So do you, I'm sure you have plans to go abroad again. Do you have any of those nailed down? Do you know when that's happening? You want to talk a little bit about those future plans?
Yeah. So actually next semester I'm studying abroad in Amman in Jordan, so the capital city, which will be a lot of fun. I'll be at the SIT program there, not the Health and Humanitarian Action, but I believe it's like diplomacy, and it's basically trying to figure out how the politics of the Middle East work. So it'll be focused mainly in Amman, and then we'll also go to the UAE, which will be a lot of fun. Because in Oman, I was actually right across the border from the UAE, but never got to go. I even looked at the UAE, but we weren't allowed thanks to the CLS. But yeah, I'll be there studying Arabic primarily because, you know, I really like that and living in Amman. And afterwards, I'll stay back a bit to do research with Bobby Cavender. So that'll be a lot of fun. Economics research. We'll see how it goes.
So just to kind of put a cap on all these places that you'll have lived for at least a few weeks, months, grew up in Kenya. Well, born in Oregon, grew up in Kenya, Gettysburg. Then you were in the Middle East in Oman for your critical language scholarship. And then you were in Israel with Inside the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And then in Morocco. And then, just for fun, going to Jordan.
Yes.
So, yeah, been around.
And that's just places I've lived.
Where else have you visited?
I've been to Germany, France, Switzerland, the UK, Ethiopia, which I highly recommend. Ethiopian food is probably the best in the world. And it pains me to say this as a Kenyan, but our food is not that great. except for chai. I will stand by chai, 100%. Uganda, Zanzibar, Tanzania. I'm sure I'm missing one or two.
And you mentioned that in the future you'd like to join the U.S. Foreign Service.
Yes.
Is there any particular aspect of that that, you know, any particular region? I mean, I assume somewhere in the Middle East, perhaps?
Yeah, I would like to work in the Middle East, but specifically I'd like to be a public diplomacy officer. So working within the Foreign Service apparatus at an embassy. And there's five different tracks, but basically the public diplomacy officer's job is to build bridges between the United States and other cultures. And I think the best way to do that is to speak the other culture's language and have intimate knowledge of the other culture's culture, so that you can lessen confusion and also work together. So
working on building bridges, I
yep.
assume. And I don't want to pivot too much into the political sphere, but but it's ever present.
It's inevitable.
So with your interest in the Foreign Service, I'm sure you're aware that the current presidential administration has proposed some pretty drastic cuts to the Department of State. What would you say to someone who suggests that diplomacy and, you know, the work of the Department of State is not valuable to Americans here at home?
I think it's interesting when you bring the administration into this, because the administration will say one thing, do another, then say another thing and do another, just like all administrations do. However, the Trump administration is unique in that way, in that they're switching all the time. Because if you look at where he is right now, he's working on building diplomatic ties with Asian countries on his longest tour ever. And I think diplomacy is key there. It's not just, oh, I'm going to visit China and, oh, I'm going to talk to South Korea. And I think that he's neglecting the Foreign Service and diplomacy in general. No one likes being punched in the face. I'd rather be told, stop doing that. I don't like that. And we can work through something. And that's, Trump is threatening a lot of things, which is like punching someone in the face before talking to them and saying, yeah, we don't agree with this. And there is a time and a place for punching someone in the face to continue going with that. I mean, you can't rule out that diplomacy works 100% of the time. But by gutting the State Department, it's really hindering U.S. diplomacy. Those are experts whose jobs are studying those countries, those cultures, those languages, who have intimate knowledge that one president will never be able to know. But if he needs it, he can call upon it. And I think I hope that he begins to fill those posts that are left unopened in the State Department mm-hmm. and lifts the hiring freeze.
Spencer King, a gentleman and a scholar and a world traveler. Thanks so much for joining us.
Nah, thanks.
That's On Target for this week. We'd like to thank Spencer King for being our featured guest today.
We'd also like to thank the staff of the Gettysburgian and the executive board of WZBT for their support of this project. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever else you get your podcast, just as long as it's somewhere we publish.
On Target is a joint production of the Gettysburgian and WZBT. Our theme music was composed by Diego Rocha, of the class of 2019, who was a music major focusing on composition from the Sunderman Conservatory of Music.